Yet a burst of anger was his answer whenever she named a reason for admiring him. He seemed to want her to consider him great, but never dare ascribe any specific content to his greatness. She did not understand the night in mid-April when he returned from a trip to Washington. "Hi, kid," he said loudly, dropping a sheaf of lilac into her arms. "Happy days are here again. Just saw those flowers and thought of you. Spring is coming, baby." He poured himself a drink and paced the room, talking with too light, too brash a manner of gaiety. There was a feverish sparkle in his eyes, and his voice seemed shredded by some unnatural excitement. She began to wonder whether he was elated or crushed. "I know what it is that they're planning," he said suddenly, without transition, and she glanced up at him swiftly. She knew the sound of one of his inner explosions. "There's not a dozen people in the whole country who know it, but I do. The top boys are keeping it secret till they're ready to spring it on the nation. Will it surprise a lot of people? Will it knock them flat?" "A lot of people? Hell, every single person in this country. It will affect every single person. That's how important it is."
"Affect how, Jim?"
"It will affect them. And they don't know what's coming, but I do. There they sit tonight," he waved at the lighted windows of the city, "making plans, counting their money, hugging their children or their dreams, and they don't know, but I do, that all of it will be struck, stopped, changed."
"Changed? For the worse or the better?"
"For the better, of course," he answered impatiently, as if it were irrelevant. His voice seemed to lose its fire and to slip into the fraudulent sound of duty. "It's a plan to save the country, to stop our economic decline, to hold things still, to achieve stability and security."
"What plan?"
"I can't tell you. It's secret, top secret. You have no idea how many people would like to know it. There's no industrialist who wouldn't give a dozen of his best furnaces for just one hint of warning, which he's not going to get. Like Hank Reardon, for instance, whom you admire so much." He chuckled, looking off into the future.
"Jim,"
she asked, the sound of fear in her voice telling him what the sound of his chuckle had been like,
"why do you hate Hank Reardon?"
"I don't hate him." He whirled to her, and his face incredibly looked anxious, almost frightened.
"I never said I hated him.
Don't worry, he'll approve of the plan. Everybody will. It's for everybody's good." He sounded as if he were pleading. She felt the dizzying certainty that he was lying, yet that the plea was sincere, as if he had a desperate need to reassure her, but not about the things he said. She forced herself to smile.
"Yes, Jim, of course,"
she answered, wondering what instinct in what impossible kind of chaos had made her say it, as if it were her part to reassure him. The look she saw on his face was almost a smile and almost of gratitude.
"I had to tell you about it tonight. I had to tell you. I wanted you to know what tremendous issues I deal with.
You always talk about my work, but you don't understand it at all. It's so much wider than you imagine. You think that running a railroad is a matter of track laying and fancy medals and getting trains there on time, but it's not. Any underling can do that. The real heart of a railroad is in Washington. My job is politics. Politics. Decisions made on a national scale, affecting everything, controlling everybody. A few words on paper, a directive, changing the life of every person in every nook, cranny, and penthouse of this country."
"Yes, Jim," she said, wishing to believe that he was perhaps a man of stature in the mysterious realm of Washington.
"You'll see," he said, pacing the room. "You think they're powerful. Those giants of industry who are so clever with motors and furnaces? They'll be stopped. They'll be stripped. They'll be brought down. They'll be—"
He noticed the way she was staring at him. "It's not for ourselves,"
he snapped hastily. It's for the people. That's the difference between business and politics. We have no selfish ends in view, no private motives. We're not after profit. We don't spend our lives scrambling for money. We don't have to. That's why we're slandered and misunderstood by all the greedy profit chasers who can't conceive of a spiritual motive or a moral ideal or... We couldn't help it, he cried suddenly, whirling to her. We had to have that plan. With everything falling to pieces and stopping, something had to be done. We had to stop them from stopping. We couldn't help it. His eyes were desperate. She did not know whether he was boasting or begging for forgiveness. She did not know whether this was triumph or terror. Jim, don't you feel well? Maybe you've worked too hard and you're worn out and... I've never felt better in my life, he snapped, resuming his pacing. You bet I've worked hard. My work is bigger than any job you can hope to imagine. It's above anything that grubbing mechanics like Reardon and my sister are doing. Whatever they do, I can undo it. Let them build a track. I can come and break it, just like that. He snapped his fingers. Just like breaking a spine. You want to break spines? She whispered, trembling. I haven't said that, he screamed. What's the matter with you? I haven't said it. I'm sorry, Jim, she gasped, shocked by her own words and by the terror in his eyes. It's just that I don't understand, but I know I shouldn't bother you with questions when you're so tired. She was struggling desperately to convince herself. When you have so many things on your mind, such great things, things I can't even begin to think of. His shoulders sagged, relaxing. He approached her and dropped wearily down on his knees, slipping his arms around her. You poor little fool, he said affectionately. She held on to him, moved by something that felt like tenderness and almost like pity. But he raised his head to glance up at her face, and it seemed to her that the look she saw in his eyes was part gratification, part contempt, almost as if, by some unknown kind of sanction, she had absolved him and damned herself. It was useless, she found in the days that followed, to tell herself that these things were beyond her understanding, that it was her duty to believe in him, that love was faith. Her doubt kept growing. Doubt of his incomprehensible work and of his relation to the railroad. She wondered why it kept growing in direct proportion to her self-admonitions that faith was the duty she owed him. Then, one sleepless night, she realized that her effort to fulfill that duty consisted of turning away whenever people discussed his job, of refusing to look at newspaper mentions of Taggart Transcontinental, of slamming her mind shut against any evidence and every contradiction. She stopped, aghast, struck by the question, "What is it, then? Faith versus truth?" And realizing that part of her zeal to believe was her fear to know, she set out to learn the truth with a cleaner, calmer sense of rightness than the effort at dutiful self-fraud had ever given her. It did not take her long to learn. The evasiveness of the Taggart executives when she asked a few casual questions, the stale generalities of their answers, the strain of their manner at the mention of their boss, and their obvious reluctance to discuss him, told her nothing concrete, but gave her a feeling equivalent to knowing the worst. The railroad workers were more specific. The switchmen, the gatemen, the ticket sellers whom she drew into chance conversations in the Taggart terminal and who did not know her. Jim Taggart? That whining, sniveling, speech-making deadhead. Jimmy the President? Well, I'll tell you. He's the hobo on the gravy train. The boss? Mr. Taggart? You mean Miss Taggart, don't you? It was Eddie Willers who told her the whole truth. She heard that he had known Jim since childhood, and she asked him to lunch with her. when she faced him at the table, when she saw the earnest, questioning directness of his eyes and the severely literal simplicity of his words, she dropped all attempts at casual prodding. She told him what she wanted to know and why, briefly, impersonally, not appealing for help or for pity, only for truth. He answered her in the same manner. He told her the whole story, quietly, impersonally, pronouncing no verdict, expressing no opinion, never encroaching on her emotions by any sign of concern for them, speaking with the shining austerity and the awesome power of facts. He told her who ran Taggart Transcontinental. He told her the story of the John Galt line. She listened, and what she felt was not shock, but worse, the lack of shock, as if she had always known it. "Thank you, Mr. Willers," was all that she said when he finished. She waited for Jim to come home that evening, and the thing that eroded any pain or indignation was a feeling of her own detachment, as if it did not matter to her any longer, as if some action were required of her, but it made no difference what the action would be, or the consequences. It was not anger that she felt when she saw Jim enter the room, but a murky astonishment, almost as if she wondered who he was and why it should now be necessary to speak to him. She told him what she knew briefly, in a tired, extinguished voice. It seemed to her that he understood it from her first few sentences, as if he had expected this to come sooner or later. "Why didn't you tell me the truth?" she asked. "So that's your idea of gratitude?" he screamed. "So that's how you feel after everything I've done for you? Everybody told me that crudeness and selfishness was all I could expect for lifting a cheap little alley cat by the scruff of her neck." She looked at him as if he were making inarticulate sounds that connected to nothing inside her mind. "Why didn't you tell me the truth? Is that all the love you felt for me, you sneaky little hypocrite? Is that all I get in return for my faith in you? Why did you lie? Why did you let me think what I thought? You should be ashamed of yourself. You should be ashamed to face me or speak to me." "I?" The inarticulate sounds had connected, but she could not believe the sum they made. "What are you trying to do, Jim?" she asked, her voice incredulous and distant. "Have you thought of my feelings? Have you thought of what this would do to my feelings? You should have considered my feelings first. That's the first obligation of any wife, and of a woman in your position in particular. There's nothing lower and uglier than ingratitude." For the flash of one instant, she grasped the unthinkable fact of a man who was guilty and knew it, and was trying to escape by inducing an emotion of guilt in his victim. But she could not hold the fact inside her brain. She felt a stab of horror, the convulsion of a mind rejecting a sight that would destroy it, a stab like a swift recoil from the edge of insanity. By the time she dropped her head, closing her eyes, she knew only that she felt disgust, a sickening disgust, for a nameless reason. When she raised her head, it seemed to her that she caught a glimpse of him watching her with the uncertain, retreating, calculating look of a man whose trick has not worked. But before she had time to believe it, his face was hidden again under an expression of injury and anger. She said, as if she were naming her thoughts for the benefit of the rational being who was not present, but whose presence she had to assume, since no other could be addressed, "That night, those headlines, that glory, it was not you at all. It was Dagny." "Shut up, you rotten little bitch!" She looked at him blankly, without reaction. She looked as if nothing could reach her, because her dying words had been uttered. He made the sound of a sob.
"Cheryl, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. I take it back, I didn't mean it."
She remained standing, leaning against the wall as she had stood from the first. He dropped down on the edge of a couch in a posture of helpless dejection.
"How could I have explained it to you?"
he said in the tone of abandoning hope.
"It's all so big and so complex. How could I have told you anything about a transcontinental railroad unless you knew all the details and ramifications? How could I have explained to you my years of work, my... Oh, what's the use? I've always been misunderstood, and I should have been accustomed to it by now, only I thought that you were different and that I had a chance.
Jim, why did you marry me?
He chuckled sadly.
That's what everybody kept asking me. I didn't think you'd ever ask it.
Why?
Because I love you.
She wondered at how strange it was that this word, which was supposed to be the simplest in the human language, the word understood by all, the universal bond among men, conveyed to her no meaning whatever. She did not know what it was that it named in his mind.
"Nobody's ever loved me," he said. "There isn't any love in the world. People don't feel. I feel things. Who cares about that? All they care for is time schedules and freight loads and money. I can't live among those people. I'm very lonely. I've always longed to find understanding. Maybe I'm just a hopeless idealist looking for the impossible. Nobody will ever understand me."
"Jim," she said, with an odd little note of severity in her voice, "what I've struggled for all this time is to understand you."
He dropped his hand in a motion of brushing her words aside, not offensively, but sadly.
"I thought you could. You're all I have. But maybe understanding is just not possible between human beings.
Why should it be impossible? Why don't you tell me what it is that you want? Why don't you help me to understand you?"
He sighed.
"That's it. That's the trouble. You're asking all those whys. Your constant asking of a why for everything. What I'm talking about can't be put into words. It can't be named. It has to be felt. Either you feel it or you don't. It's not a thing of the mind, but of the heart. Don't you ever feel? Just feel, without asking all those questions? Can't you understand me as a human being, not as if I were a scientific object in a laboratory? The great understanding that transcends our shabby words and helpless minds. No, I guess I shouldn't look for it. But I'll always seek and hope. You're my last hope. You're all I have."
She stood at the wall, without moving.
"I need you," he wailed softly. "I'm all alone. You're not like the others. I believe in you. I trust you. What has all that money and fame and business and struggle given me? You're all I have."
She stood without moving, and the direction of her glance, lowered to look down at him, was the only form of recognition she gave him. The things he said about his suffering were lies, she thought. But the suffering was real. He was a man torn by some continual anguish which he seemed unable to tell her, but which, perhaps, she could learn to understand. She still owed him this much, she thought, with a grayness of a sense of duty, in payment for the position he had given her, which, perhaps, was all he had to give. She owed him an effort to understand him. It was strange to feel, in the days that followed, that she had become a stranger to herself, a stranger who had nothing to want or to seek. In place of a love made by the brilliant fire of hero worship, she was left with the gnawing drabness of pity. In place of the men she had struggled to find, men who fought for their goals and refused to suffer, she was left with a man whose suffering was his only claim to value and his only offer in exchange for her life. But it made no difference to her any longer. The one who was she had looked with eagerness at the turn of every corner ahead. The passive stranger who had taken her place was like all the over-groomed people around her, the people who said that they were adult because they did not try to think or to desire. But the stranger was still haunted by a ghost who was herself, and the ghost had a mission to accomplish.
She had to learn to understand the things that had destroyed her. She had to know, and she lived with a sense of ceaseless waiting. She had to know, even though she felt that the headlight was closer, and in the moment of knowledge, she would be struck by the wheels. "What do you want of me?" was the question that kept beating in her mind as a clue. "What do you want of me?" she kept crying soundlessly at dinner tables, in drawing rooms, on sleepless nights, crying it to Jim and those who seemed to share his secret, to Balfe Eubank, to Dr. Simon Pritchett. "What do you want of me?" She did not ask it aloud. She knew that they would not answer. "What do you want of me?" she asked, feeling as if she were running, but no way were open to escape. "What do you want of me?" she asked, looking at the whole long torture of her marriage that had not lasted the full span of 1 year. "What do you want of me?" she asked aloud, and saw that she was sitting at the table in her dining room, looking at Jim, at his feverish face, and at a drying stain of water on the table. She did not know how long a span of silence had stretched between them. She was startled by her own voice and by the question she had not intended to utter. She did not expect him to understand it. He had never seemed to understand much simpler queries, and she shook her head, struggling to recapture the reality of the present. She was startled to see him looking at her with a touch of derision, as if he were mocking her estimate of his understanding. "Love," he answered. She felt herself sagging with hopelessness in the face of that answer which was at once so simple and so meaningless. "You don't love me," he said accusingly. She did not answer. "You don't love me or you wouldn't ask such a question." "I did love you once," she said dully, "but it wasn't what you wanted. I loved you for your courage, your ambition, your ability. But it wasn't real, any of it." His lower lip swelled a little in a faint, contemptuous thrust. "What a shabby idea of love," he said. "Jim, what is it that you want to be loved for?" "What a cheap shopkeeper's attitude." She did not speak. She looked at him, her eyes stretched by a silent question. "To be loved for," he said, his voice grating with mockery and righteousness. "So you think that love is a matter of mathematics, of exchange, of weighing and measuring, like a pound of butter on a grocery counter? I don't want to be loved for anything. I want to be loved for myself, not for anything I do or have or say or think. For myself. Not for my body or mind or words or works or actions. But then, what is yourself? If you loved me, you wouldn't ask it." His voice had a shrill note of nervousness, as if he were swaying dangerously between caution and some blindly heedless impulse. "You wouldn't ask. You'd know. You'd feel it. Why do you always try to tag and label everything? Can't you rise above those petty materialistic definitions? Don't you ever feel? Just feel?" "Yes, Jim, I do," she said, her voice low. "But I am trying not to, because what I feel is fear." "Of me?" he asked, hopefully. "No, not exactly. Not fear of what you can do to me, but of what you are." He dropped his eyelids with the swiftness of slamming a door, but she caught a flash of his eyes, and the flash, incredibly, was terror. "You're not capable of love, you cheap little gold digger," he cried suddenly, in a tone stripped of all color but the desire to hurt. "Yes, I said gold digger. There are many forms of it other than greed for money, other and worse. You're a gold digger of the spirit. You didn't marry me for my cash, but you married me for my ability or courage or whatever value it was that you set as the price of your love.
do you want love to be causeless? Love is its own cause. Love is above causes and reasons. Love is blind. But you wouldn't be capable of it. You have the mean, scheming, calculating little soul of a shopkeeper who trades but never gives. Love is a gift, a great, free, unconditional gift that transcends and forgives everything. What's the generosity of loving a man for his virtues? What do you give him? Nothing. It's no more than cold justice, no more than he's earned. Her eyes were dark with the dangerous intensity of glimpsing her goal. You want it to be unearned, she said, not in the tone of a question, but of a verdict. Oh, you don't understand. Yes, Jim, I do. That's what you want. That's what all of you really want. Not money, not material benefits, not economic security, not any of the handouts you keep demanding. She spoke in a flat monotone, as if reciting her thoughts to herself, intent upon giving the solid identity of words to the torturous shreds of chaos twisting in her mind. All of you welfare preachers, it's not unearned money that you're after. You want handouts, but of a different kind. I'm a gold digger of the spirit, you said, because I look for value. Then you, the welfare preachers, it's the spirit that you want to loot. I never thought, and nobody ever told us, how it could be thought of and what it would mean. The unearned in spirit. But that is what you want. You want unearned love. You want unearned admiration. You want unearned greatness. You want to be a man like Hank Reardon without the necessity of being what he is. Without the necessity of being anything. Without the necessity of being. Shut up, he screamed. They looked at each other, both in terror, both feeling as if they were swaying on an edge which she could not and he would not name, both knowing that one more step would be fatal. What do you think you're saying? He asked in a tone of petty anger, which sounded almost benevolent by bringing them back into the realm of the normal, into the near wholesomeness of nothing worse than a family quarrel. What sort of metaphysical subject are you trying to deal with? I don't know, she said wearily, dropping her head, as if some shape she had tried to capture had slipped once more out of her grasp. I don't know. It doesn't seem possible. You'd better not try to wade in way over your head, or... But he had to stop, because the butler entered, bringing the glittering ice bucket with the champagne ordered for the celebration. They remained silent, letting the room be filled by the sounds which centuries of men and of struggle had established as the symbol of joyous attainment. The blast of the cork, the laughing tinkle of a pale gold liquid running into two broad cups filled with the weaving reflections of candles, the whisper of bubbles rising through two crystal stems, almost demanding that everything in sight rise, too, in the same aspiration. They remained silent till the butler had gone. Taggart sat looking down at the bubbles, holding the stem of his glass between two limply casual fingers. Then his hand closed suddenly about the stem into an awkwardly convulsed fist, and he raised it, not as one lifts a glass of champagne, but as one would lift a butcher knife. "To Francisco d'Anconia," he said. She put her glass down. "No," she answered. "Drink it," he screamed. "No," she answered, her voice like a drop of lead. They held each other's glances for a moment, the light playing on the golden liquid, not reaching their faces or eyes. "Oh, go to hell," he cried, leaping to his feet, flinging his glass to smash on the floor
and rushing out of the room. She sat at the table, not moving, for a long time, then rose slowly and pressed the bell. She walked to her room, her steps unnaturally even. She opened the door of a closet. She reached for a suit and a pair of shoes. She took off the housecoat, moving with cautious precision, as if her life depended on not jarring anything about or within her. She held on to a single thought, that she had to get out of this house. Just get out of it for a while, if only for the next hour. And then, later, she would be able to face all that had to be faced. The lines were blurring on the paper before her, and raising her head, Dagny realized that it had long since grown dark. She pushed the papers aside, unwilling to turn on the lamp, permitting herself the luxury of idleness and darkness. It cut her off from the city beyond the windows of her living room. The calendar in the distance said August 5th. The month behind her had gone, leaving nothing but the blank of dead time. It had gone into the planless, thankless work of racing from emergency to emergency, of delaying the collapse of a railroad. A month like a waste pile of disconnected days, each given to averting the disaster of the moment. It had not been a sum of achievements brought into existence, but only a sum of zeros, of that which had not happened, a sum of prevented catastrophes, not a task in the service of life, but only a race against death. There had been times when an unsummoned vision, a sight of the valley, had seemed to rise before her, not as a sudden appearance, but as a constant hidden presence that suddenly chose to assume an insistent reality. She had faced it, through moments of blinded stillness, in a contest between an unmoving decision and an unyielding pain, a pain to be fought by acknowledgement, by saying, all right, even this. There had been mornings when, awakening with rays of sunlight on her face, she had thought that she must hurry to Hammond's Market to get fresh eggs for breakfast. Then, recapturing full consciousness, seeing the haze of New York beyond the window of her bedroom, she had felt a tearing stab, like a touch of death, the touch of rejecting reality. You knew it, she had told herself severely. You knew what it would be like when you made your choice. And dragging her body, like an unwilling weight, out of bed to face an unwelcome day, she would whisper, all right. Even this. The worst of the torture had been the moments when, walking down the street, she had caught a sudden glimpse of chestnut gold, a glowing streak of hair among the heads of strangers, and had felt as if the city had vanished, as if nothing but the violent stillness within her were delaying the moment when she would rush to him and seize him. But that next moment had come as the sight of some meaningless face, and she had stood, not wishing to live through the following step, not wishing to generate the energy of living. She had tried to avoid such moments. She had tried to forbid herself to look. She had walked, keeping her eyes on the pavements. She had failed. By some will of their own, her eyes had kept leaping to every streak of gold. She had kept the blinds raised on the windows of her office, remembering his promise, thinking only, if you are watching me, wherever you are. There were no buildings close to the height of her office, but she had looked at the distant towers, wondering which window was his observation post, wondering whether some invention of his own, some device of rays and lenses, permitted him to observe her every movement from some skyscraper a block or a mile away. She had sat at her desk, at her uncurtained windows, thinking, just to know that you're seeing me, even if I'm never to see you again. And remembering it now, in the darkness of her room, she leaped to her feet and snapped on the light. Then she dropped her head for an instant, smiling in mirthless amusement at herself. She wondered whether her lighted windows, in the black immensity of the city, were a flare of distress, calling for his help, or a lighthouse still protecting the rest of the world. The doorbell rang. When she opened the door, she saw the silhouette of a girl with a faintly familiar face. and it took her a moment of startled astonishment to realize that it was Cheryl Taggart. Except for a formal exchange of greetings on a few chance encounters in the halls of the Taggart building, they had not seen each other since the wedding. Cheryl's face was composed and unsmiling.
"Would you permit me to speak to you?"
She hesitated and ended on,
"Miss Taggart?"
"Of course," said Dagny gravely.
"Come in."
She sensed some desperate emergency in the unnatural calm of Cheryl's manner. She became certain of it when she looked at the girl's face in the light of the living room.
"Sit down," she said,
but Cheryl remained standing.
"I came to pay a debt," said Cheryl,
her voice solemn with the effort to permit herself no sound of emotion.
"I want to apologize for the things I said to you at my wedding. There's no reason why you should forgive me, but it's my place to tell you that I know I was insulting everything I admire and defending everything I despise. I know that admitting it now doesn't make up for it, and even coming here is only another presumption. There's no reason why you should want to hear it, so I can't even cancel the debt. I can only ask for a favor. That you let me say the things I want to say to you."
Dagny's shock of emotion, incredulous, warm, and painful, was the wordless equivalent of the sentence, "What a distance to travel in less than a year." She answered, the unsmiling earnestness of her voice like a hand extended in support, knowing that a smile would upset some precarious balance.
"But it does make up for it, and I do want to hear it. I know that it was you who ran Taggart Transcontinental. It was you who built the John Galt line. It was you who had the mind and the courage that kept all of it alive. I suppose you thought that I married Jim for his money, as what shop girl wouldn't have? But you see, I married Jim because I thought that he was you. I thought that he was Taggart Transcontinental. Now I know that he's..."
She hesitated, then went on firmly, as if not to spare herself anything.
"He's some sort of vicious moocher, though I can't understand of what kind or why. When I spoke to you at my wedding, I thought that I was defending greatness and attacking its enemy. But it was in reverse. It was in such horrible, unbelievable reverse. So I wanted to tell you that I know the truth. Not so much for your sake. I have no right to presume that you'd care, but for the sake of the things I loved."
Dagny said slowly,
"Of course I forgive it."
"Thank you,"
she whispered, and turned to go.
"Sit down."
She shook her head.
That was all, Miss Taggart."
Dagny allowed herself the first touch of a smile, no more than in the look of her eyes, as she said,
"Cheryl, my name is Dagny."
Cheryl's answer was no more than a faint, tremulous crease of her mouth, as if together they had completed a single smile.
I didn't know whether I should..."
"We're sisters, aren't we?"
"No. Not through Jim."
It was an involuntary cry.
"No, through our own choice. Sit down, Cheryl."
The girl obeyed, struggling not to show the eagerness of her acceptance, not to grasp for support, not to break.
"You've had a terrible time, haven't you?"
"Yes, but that doesn't matter. That's my own problem. And my own fault."
"I don't think it was your own fault."
Cheryl did not answer, then said suddenly, desperately,
"Look, what I don't want is charity."
"Jim must have told you, and it's true, that I never engage in charity."
"Yes, he did. But what I mean is..."
"I know what you mean.
But there's no reason why you should have to feel concern for me. I didn't come here to complain, and and load another burden on your shoulders? That I happen to suffer doesn't give me a claim on you.
No, it doesn't. But that you value all the things I value does.
You mean, if you want to talk to me, it's not alms? Not just because you feel sorry for me?
I feel terribly sorry for you, Cheryl, and I'd like to help you, not because you suffer, but because you haven't deserved to suffer.
You mean, you wouldn't be kind to anything weak or whining or rotten about me, only to whatever you see in me that's good?
Of course.
Cheryl did not move her head, but she looked as if it were lifted, as if some bracing current were relaxing her features into that rare look which combines pain and dignity.
It's not alms, Cheryl. Don't be afraid to speak to me.
It's strange. You're the first person I can talk to, and it feels so easy, yet I was afraid to speak to you. I wanted to ask your forgiveness long ago, ever since I learned the truth. I went as far as the door of your office, but I stopped and stood there in the hall and didn't have the courage to go in. I didn't intend to come here tonight. I went out only to think something over, and then suddenly I knew that I wanted to see you, that in the whole of the city this was the only place for me to go, and the only thing still left for me to do.
I'm glad you did.
You know, Miss Dagny, she said softly, in wonder, you're not as I expected you to be at all. Jim and his friends, they said you were hard and cold and unfeeling.
But it's true, Cheryl. I am, in the sense they mean. Only have they ever told you in just what sense they mean it?
No, they never do. They only sneer at me when I ask them what they mean by anything, about anything. What did they mean about you?
Whenever anyone accuses some person of being unfeeling, he means that that person is just. He means that that person has no causeless emotions and will not grant him a feeling which he does not deserve. He means that to feel is to go against reason, against moral values, against reality. He means...
What's the matter?
She asked, seeing the abnormal intensity of the girl's face.
It's something I've tried so hard to understand for such a long time.
Well, observe that you never hear that accusation in defense of innocence, but always in defense of guilt. You never hear it said by a good person about those who fail to do him justice, but you always hear it said by a rotter about those who treat him as a rotter, those who don't feel any sympathy for the evil he's committed or for the pain he suffers as a consequence.
Well, it's true.
That is what I do not feel. But those who feel it feel nothing for any quality of human greatness, for any person or action that deserves admiration, approval, esteem. These are the things I feel. You'll find that it's one or the other. Those who grant sympathy to guilt grant none to innocence. Ask yourself which of the two are the unfeeling persons, and then you'll see what motive is the opposite of charity.
What? She whispered.
Justice, Cheryl.
Cheryl shuddered suddenly and dropped her head.
Oh, God, she moaned. If you knew what hell Jim has been giving me because I believed just what you said.
She raised her face in the sweep of another shudder, as if the things she had tried to control had broken through. The look in her eyes was terror.
Dagny, she whispered. Dagny, I'm afraid of them. Of Jim and all the others. Not afraid of something they'll do. If it were that, I could escape. But afraid, as if there's no way out. afraid of what they are and that they exist.
Dagny came forward swiftly to sit on the arm of her chair and seize her shoulder in a steadying grasp.
Quiet, kid, she said. You're wrong. You must never feel afraid of people in that way. You must never think that their existence is a reflection on yours. Yet that's what you're thinking.
Yes. Yes, I feel that there's no chance for me to exist if they do. No chance, no room, no world I can cope with. I don't want to feel it. I keep pushing it back, but it's coming closer, and I know I have no place to run. I can't explain what it feels like. I can't catch hold of it. And that's part of the terror, that you can't catch hold of anything. It's as if the whole world were suddenly destroyed, but not by an explosion. An explosion is something hard and solid, but destroyed by some horrible kind of softening. As if nothing were solid, nothing held any shape at all, and you could poke your finger through stone walls, and the stone would give like jelly, and mountains would slither, and buildings would switch their shapes like clouds. And that would be the end of the world. Not fire and brimstone, but goo.
Cheryl, Cheryl, you poor kid, there have been centuries of philosophers plotting to turn the world into just that, to destroy people's minds by making them believe that that's what they're seeing. But you don't have to accept it. You don't have to see through the eyes of others. Hold on to yours. Stand on your own judgment. You know that what is, is. Say it aloud, like the holiest of prayers, and don't let anyone tell you otherwise.
But nothing is anymore. Jim and his friends, they're not. I don't know what I'm looking at when I'm among them. I don't know what I'm hearing when they speak. It's not real, any of it. It's some ghastly sort of act that they're all going through. And I don't know what they're after. Dagny, we've always been told that human beings have such a great power of knowledge, so much greater than animals, but I feel blinder than any animal right now, blinder and more helpless. An animal knows who are its friends and who are its enemies, and when to defend itself. It doesn't expect a friend to step on it or to cut its throat. It doesn't expect to be told that love is blind, that plunder is achievement, that gangsters are statesmen, and that it's great to break the spine of Hank Reardon. Oh, God, what am I saying?
I know what you're saying.
I mean, how am I to deal with people? I mean, if nothing held firm for the length of 1 hour, we couldn't go on, could we? Well, I know that things are solid. But people? Dagny, they're nothing and anything. They're not beings. They're only switches, just constant switches without any shape. But I have to live among them. How am I to do it?
Cheryl, what you've been struggling with is the greatest problem in history, the one that has caused all of human suffering. You've understood much more than most people who suffer and die, never knowing what killed them. I'll help you to understand. It's a big subject and a hard battle. But first, above all, don't be afraid.
The look on Cheryl's face was an odd, wistful longing, as if, seeing Dagny from a great distance, she were straining and failing to come closer.
I wish I could wish to fight, she said softly. But I don't. I don't even want to win any longer. There's one change that I don't seem to have the strength to make. You see, I had never expected anything like my marriage to Jim. Then when it happened, I thought that life was much more wonderful than I had expected. And now to get used to the idea that life and people are much more horrible than anything I had imagined, and that my marriage was not a glorious miracle, but some unspeakable kind of evil which I'm still afraid to learn fully. That is what I can't force myself to take. I can't get past it. She glanced up suddenly. Dagny, how did you do it? How did you manage to remain unmangled?
By holding to just one rule.
Which?
To place nothing, nothing, above the verdict of my own mind.
You've taken some terrible beatings, maybe worse than I did, worse than any of us. What held you through it?
The knowledge that my life is the highest of values, too high to give up without a fight. She saw a look of astonishment, of incredulous recognition on Cheryl's face, as if the girl were struggling to recapture some sensation across a span of years.
Dagny,
her voice was a whisper.
That's what I felt when I was a child. That's what I seem to remember most about myself. That kind of feeling. And I never lost it. It's there. It's always been there, but as I grew up, I thought it was something that I must hide. I never had any name for it, but just now, when you said it, it struck me that that's what it was. Dagny, to feel that way about your own life? Is that good?
Cheryl, listen to me carefully. That feeling, with everything which it requires and implies, is the highest, noblest, and only good on earth.
The reason I ask is because I wouldn't have dared to think that. Somehow people always made me feel as if they thought it was a sin, as if that were the thing in me which they resented and wanted to destroy.
It's true. Some people do want to destroy it. And when you learn to understand their motive, you'll know the darkest, ugliest, and only evil in the world. But you'll be safely out of its reach.
Cheryl's smile was like a feeble flicker, struggling to retain its hold upon a few drops of fuel, to catch them, to flare up.
It's the first time in months, she whispered, that I've felt as if there's still a chance.
She saw Dagny's eyes watching her with attentive concern, and she added,
I'll be all right. Let me get used to it. To you, to all the things you said. I think I'll come to believe it. To believe that it's real. And that Jim doesn't matter.
She rose to her feet, as if trying to retain the moment of assurance. Prompted by a sudden, causeless certainty, Dagny said sharply,
Cheryl, I don't want you to go home tonight.
Oh, no. I'm all right. I'm not afraid that way. Not of going home.
Didn't something happen there tonight?
No. Not really. Nothing worse than usual. It was just that I began to see things a little more clearly, that was all. I'm all right. I have to think harder than I ever did before. And then I'll decide what I must do. May I?
She hesitated. Yes?
May I come back to talk to you again?
Of course.
Thank you. I'm very grateful to you.
Will you promise me that you'll come back?
I promise.
Dagny saw her walking off down the hall toward the elevator, saw the slump of her shoulders, then the effort that lifted them, saw the slender figure that seemed to sway, then marshal all of its strength to remain erect. She looked like a plant with a broken stem, still held together by a single fiber, struggling to heal the breach, which one more gust of wind would finish. Through the open door of his study, James Taggart had seen Cheryl cross the anteroom and walk out of the apartment. He had slammed his door and slumped down on the davenport, with patches of spilled champagne still soaking the cloth of his trousers, as if his own discomfort were a revenge upon his wife
and upon a universe that would not provide him with the celebration he had wanted. After a while, he leaped to his feet, tore off his coat, and threw it across the room. He reached for a cigarette, but snapped it in half and flung it at a painting over the fireplace. He noticed a vase of Venetian glass, a museum piece, centuries old, with an intricate system of blue and gold arteries twisting through its transparent body. He seized it and flung it at the wall. It burst into a rain of glass as thin as a shattered light bulb. He had bought that vase for the satisfaction of thinking of all the connoisseurs who could not afford it. Now he experienced the satisfaction of a revenge upon the centuries which had prized it, and the satisfaction of thinking that there were millions of desperate families, any one of whom could have lived for a year on the price of that vase. He kicked off his shoes and fell back on the davenport, letting his stocking feet dangle in midair. The sound of the doorbell startled him. It seemed to match his mood. It was the kind of brusque, demanding, impatient snap of sound he would have produced if he were now jabbing his finger at someone's doorbell. He listened to the butler's steps, promising himself the pleasure of refusing admittance to whoever was seeking it. In a moment he heard the knock at his door, and the butler entered to announce, "Mrs. Reardon to see you, sir." "What? Oh. Well, have her come in." He swung his feet down to the floor, but made no other concession, and waited with half a smile of alerted curiosity, choosing not to rise until a moment after Lillian had entered the room. She wore a wine-colored dinner gown, an imitation of an Empire traveling suit, with a miniature double-breasted jacket gripping her high waistline over the long sweep of the skirt, and a small hat clinging to one ear, with a feather sweeping down to curl under her chin. She entered with a brusque, unrhythmical motion, the train of her dress and the feather of her hat swirling, then flapping against her legs and throat, like pennants signaling nervousness. "Lillian, my dear, am I to be flattered, delighted, or just plain flabbergasted? Oh, don't make a fuss about it. I had to see you, and it had to be immediately, that's all." The impatient tone, the peremptory movement with which she sat down were a confession of weakness. By the rules of their unwritten language, one did not assume a demanding manner unless one were seeking a favor and had no value, no threat, to barter. "Why didn't you stay at the Gonzales reception?" she asked, her casual smile failing to hide the tone of irritation. "I dropped in on them after dinner just to catch hold of you, but they said you hadn't been feeling well and had gone home." He crossed the room and picked up a cigarette, for the pleasure of padding in his stocking feet past the formal elegance of her costume. "I was bored," he answered. "I can't stand them," she said, with a little shudder. He glanced at her in astonishment. The words sounded involuntary and sincere. "I can't stand Señor Gonzales and that whore he's got himself for a wife. It's disgusting that they've become so fashionable, they and their parties. I don't feel like going anywhere any longer. It's not the same style anymore, not the same spirit. I haven't run into Balfe Eubank for months, or Dr. Pritchett, or any of the boys. And all those new faces that look like butcher's assistants. After all, our crowd were gentlemen." "Yeah," he said reflectively. "Yeah, there's some funny kind of difference. It's like on the railroad, too. I could get along with Clem Weatherby, he was civilized. But Cuffy Meggs, that's something else again, that's..." He stopped abruptly. "It's perfectly preposterous," she said, in the tone of a challenge to the space at large. "They can't get away with it." She did not explain who or with what. He knew what she meant. Through a moment of silence, they looked as if they were clinging to each other for reassurance. In the next moment, he was thinking with pleasurable amusement that Lillian was beginning to show her age. The deep burgundy color of her gown was unbecoming. It seemed to draw a purplish tinge out of her skin, a tinge that gathered like twilight in the small gullies of her face, softening her flesh to a texture of tired slackness, changing her look of bright mockery into a look of stale malice. He saw her studying him, smiling and saying crisply, with the smile as license for insult, You are unwell, aren't you, Jim? You look like a disorganized stable boy. He chuckled. I can afford it. I know it, darling. You're one of the most powerful men in New York City. She added, it's a good joke on New York City. It is. I concede that you're in a position to do anything. That's why I had to see you. She added a small, grunt-like sound of amusement to dilute her statement's frankness. Good, he said, his voice comfortable and noncommittal. I had to come here because I thought it best, in this particular matter, not to be seen together in public. That is always wise. I seem to remember having been useful to you in the past. In the past, yes. I am sure that I can count on you. Of course. Only isn't that an old-fashioned, unphilosophical remark? How can we ever be sure of anything? Jim, she snapped suddenly, you've got to help me. My dear, I'm at your disposal. I'd do anything to help you, he answered, the rules of their language requiring that any open statement be answered by a blatant lie. Lillian was slipping, he thought, and he experienced the pleasure of dealing with an inadequate adversary. She was neglecting, he noted, even the perfection of her particular trademark, her grooming. A few strands were escaping from the drilled waves of her hair. Her nails, matching her gown, were the deep shade of coagulated blood, which made it easy to notice the chipped polish at their tips. And against the broad, smooth, creamy expanse of her skin in the low, square cut of her gown, he observed the tiny glitter of a safety pin holding the strap of her slip. You've got to prevent it, she said, in the belligerent tone of a plea disguised as a command. You've got to stop it. Really? What? My divorce. Oh. His features dropped into sudden earnestness. You know that he's going to divorce me, don't you? I've heard some rumors about it. It's set for next month. And when I say set, that's just what I mean. Oh, it's cost him plenty. But he's bought the judge, the clerks, the bailiffs, their backers' backers, a few legislators, half a dozen administrators. He's bought the whole legal process, like a private thoroughfare, and there's no single crossroad left for me to squeeze through to stop it. I see. You know, of course, what made him start divorce proceedings. I can guess. And I did it as a favor to you. Her voice was growing anxiously shrill. I told you about your sister in order to let you get that gift certificate for your friends, which... I swear I don't know who let it out, he cried hastily. Only a very few at the top knew that you'd been our informer, and I'm sure nobody would dare mention. Oh, I'm sure nobody did. He'd have the brains to guess it, wouldn't he? Yes, I suppose so. Well, then you knew that you were taking a chance. I didn't think he'd go that far. I didn't think he'd ever divorce me. I didn't... He chuckled suddenly, with a glance of astonishing perceptiveness. You didn't think that guilt is a rope that wears thin, did you, Lillian? She looked at him, startled, then answered stonily, I don't think it does. It does, my dear, for men such as your husband. I don't want him to divorce me. It was a sudden scream. I don't want to let him go free. I won't permit it. I won't let the whole of my life be a total failure. She stopped abruptly, as if she had admitted too much. He was chuckling softly, nodding his head with a slow movement that had an air of intelligence, almost of dignity, by signifying a complete understanding. I mean, after all, he's my husband, she said defensively. Yes, Lillian, yes. I know. Do you know what he's planning? He's going to get the decree, and he's going to cut me off without a penny. No settlement, no alimony, nothing. He's going to have the last word.
Don't you see? If he gets away with it, then the gift certificate was no victory for me at all.
Yes, my dear, I see.
And besides, it's preposterous that I should have to think of it, but what am I going to live on? The little money I had of my own is worth nothing nowadays. It's mainly stock in factories of my father's time that have closed long ago. What am I going to do?
But Lillian, he said softly, I thought you had no concern for money or for any material rewards.
You don't understand. I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about poverty. Real, stinking, hall-bedroom poverty. That's out of bounds for any civilized person. I, to have to worry about food and rent?
He was watching her with a faint smile. For once, his soft, aging face seemed tightened into a look of wisdom. He was discovering the pleasure of full perception in a reality which he could permit himself to perceive.
Jim, you've got to help me. My lawyer is powerless. I've spent the little I had on him and on his investigators, friends and fixers, but all they could do for me was find out that they can do nothing. My lawyer gave me his final report this afternoon. He told me bluntly that I haven't a chance. I don't seem to know anyone who can help against a setup of this kind. I had counted on Bertram Scudder, but... well, you know what happened to Bertram. And that, too, was because I had tried to help you. You pulled yourself out of that one. Jim, you're the only person who can pull me out now. You've got your gopher hole pipeline straight up to the top. You can reach the big boys. Slip a word to your friends, to slip a word to their friends. One word from Wesley would do it. Have them order that divorce decree to be refused. Just have it be refused.
He shook his head slowly, almost compassionately, like a tired professional at an overzealous amateur.
It can't be done, Lillian, he said firmly. I'd like to do it, for the same reasons as yours, and I think you know it. But whatever power I have is not enough in this case.
She was looking at him, her eyes dark with an odd, lifeless stillness. When she spoke, the motion of her lips was twisted by so evil a contempt that he did not dare identify it beyond knowing that it embraced them both. She said,
I know that you'd like to do it.
He felt no desire to pretend. Oddly, for the first time, for this one chance, truth seemed much more pleasurable. Truth, for once, serving his particular kind of enjoyment.
I think you know that it can't be done, he said. Nobody does favors nowadays if there's nothing to gain in return. And the stakes are getting higher and higher. The gopher holes, as you called them, are so complex, so twisted and intertwisted that everybody has something on everybody else, and nobody dares move because he can't tell who'll crack which way or when. So he'll move only when he has to, when the stakes are life or death. And that's practically the only kind of stakes we're playing for now. Well, what's your private life to any of those boys? That you'd like to hold your husband, what's in it for them one way or another? And my personal stock in trade? Well, there's nothing I could offer them at the moment in exchange for trying to blast a whole court clique out of a highly profitable deal. Besides, right now, the top boys wouldn't do it at any price. They have to be mighty careful of your husband. He's the man who's safe from them right now, ever since that radio broadcast of my sister's. You asked me to force her to speak on that broadcast. I know, Lillian. We lost both of us that time, and we lose both of us now.
Yes, she said, with the same darkness of contempt in her eyes. Both of us.
It was the contempt that pleased him. It was the strange, heedless, unfamiliar pleasure of knowing that this woman saw him as he was, yet remained held by his presence, remained and leaned back in her chair, as if declaring her bondage. "You're a wonderful person, Jim," she said. It had the sound of damnation, yet it was a tribute, and she meant it as such, and his pleasure came from the knowledge that they were in a realm where damnation was value. "You know," he said suddenly, "you're wrong about those butcher's assistants like Gonzalez. They have their uses. Have you ever liked Francisco D'Anconia? I can't stand him. Well, do you know the real purpose of that cocktail-swilling occasion staged by Senor Gonzalez tonight? It was to celebrate the agreement to nationalize D'Anconia Copper in about a month." She looked at him for a moment, the corners of her lips lifting slowly into a smile. "He was your friend, wasn't he?" Her voice had a tone he had never earned before, the tone of an emotion which he had drawn from people only by fraud, but which now, for the first time, was granted with full awareness to the real, the actual nature of his deed. A tone of admiration. Suddenly he knew that this was the goal of his restless hours. This was the pleasure he had despaired of finding. This was the celebration he had wanted. "Let's have a drink, Lil," he said. Pouring the liquor, he glanced at her across the room as she lay stretched limply in her chair. "Let him get his divorce," he said. "He won't have the last word. They will. The butcher's assistants. Senor Gonzalez and Cuffy Meggs." She did not answer. When he approached, she took the glass from him with a sloppily indifferent sweep of her hand. She drank, not in the manner of a social gesture, but like a lonely drinker in a saloon, for the physical sake of the liquor. He sat down on the arm of the davenport, improperly close to her, and sipped his drink, watching her face. After a while, he asked, "What does he think of me?" The question did not seem to astonish her. "He thinks you're a fool," she answered. "He thinks life's too short to have to notice your existence." "He'd notice it if..." He stopped. "If you bashed him over the head with a club?" "I'm not too sure. He'd merely blame himself for not having moved out of the club's reach. Still, that would be your only chance." She shifted her body, sliding lower in the armchair, stomach forward, as if relaxation were ugliness, as if she were granting him the kind of intimacy that required no poise and no respect. "That was the first thing I noticed about him," she said, "when I met him for the first time, that he was not afraid. He looked as if he felt certain that there was nothing any of us could do to him. So certain that he didn't even know the issue or the nature of what he felt." "How long since you saw him last?"
3 months. "I haven't seen him since the gift certificate."
"I saw him at an industrial meeting 2 weeks ago. He still looks that way, only more so. Now he looks as if he knows it." He added, "You have failed, Lillian." She did not answer. She pushed her hat off with the back of her hand. It rolled down to the carpet, its feather curling like a question mark.
"I remember the first time I saw his mills," she said. "His mills. You can't imagine what he felt about them. You wouldn't know the kind of intellectual arrogance it takes to feel as if anything pertaining to him, anything he touched, were made sacred by the touch. His mills, his metal, his money, his bed, his wife." She glanced up at him, a small flicker piercing the lethargic emptiness of her eyes. "He never noticed your existence. He did notice mine. I'm still Mrs. Reardon, at least for another month."
"Yes," he said, looking down at her with a sudden new interest.
"Mrs. Reardon," she chuckled. "You wouldn't know what that meant to him.
No feudal lord ever felt or demanded such reverence for the title of his wife, or held it as such a symbol of honor, of his unbending, untouchable, inviolate, stainless honor. She waved her hand in a vague motion, indicating the length of her sprawled body. Caesar's wife, she chuckled. Do you remember what she was supposed to be? No, you wouldn't. She was supposed to be above reproach. He was staring down at her with the heavy, blind stare of impotent hatred, a hatred of which she was the sudden symbol, not the object. He didn't like it when his medal was thrown into common public use for any chance passerby to make, did he? No, he didn't. His words were blurring a little, as if weighted with drops of the liquor he had swallowed. Don't tell me that you helped us to get that gift certificate as a favor to me and that you gained nothing. I know why you did it. You knew it at the time. Sure. That's why I like you, Lillian. His eyes kept coming back to the low cut of her gown. It was not the smooth skin that attracted his glance, not the exposed rise of her breasts, but the fraud of the safety pin beyond the edge. I'd like to see him beaten, he said. I'd like to hear him scream with pain just once. You won't, Jimmy. Why does he think he's better than the rest of us? He and that sister of mine. She chuckled. He rose as if she had slapped him. He went to the bar and poured himself another drink, not offering to refill her glass. She was speaking into space, staring past him. He did notice my existence, even though I can't lay railroad tracks for him and erect bridges to the glory of his metal. I can't build his mills. But I can destroy them. I can't produce his metal, but I can take it away from him. I can't bring men down to their knees in admiration, but I can bring them down to their knees. Shut up! He screamed in terror, as if she were coming too close to that fog-bound alley which had to remain unseen. She glanced up at his face. You're such a coward, Jim. Why don't you get drunk? He snapped, sticking his unfinished drink at her mouth as if he wanted to strike her. Her fingers half closed limply about the glass, and she drank, spilling the liquor down her chin, her breast, and her gown. Oh, hell, Lillian, you're a mess, he said, and not troubling to reach for his handkerchief, he stretched out his hand to wipe the liquor with the flat of his palm. His fingers slipped under the gown's neckline, closing over her breast, his breath catching in a sudden gulp, like a hiccup. His eyes were drawing closed, but he caught a glimpse of her face leaning back unresistingly, her mouth swollen with revulsion. When he reached for her mouth, her arms embraced him obediently, and her mouth responded, but the response was just a pressure, not a kiss. He raised his head to glance at her face. Her teeth were bared in a smile, but she was staring past him, as if mocking some invisible presence, her smile lifeless, yet loud with malice, like the grin of a fleshless skull. He jerked her closer to stifle the sight and his own shudder. His hands were going through the automatic motions of intimacy, and she complied, but in a manner that made him feel as if the beats of her arteries under his touch were snickering giggles. They were both performing an expected routine, a routine invented by someone and imposed upon them, performing it in mockery, in hatred, in defiling parody on its inventors. He felt a sightless, heedless fury, part horror, part pleasure, the horror of committing an act he would never dare confess to anyone, the pleasure of committing it in blasphemous defiance of those to whom he would not dare confess it. He was himself. The only conscious part of his rage seemed to be screaming to him. He was, at last, himself. They did not speak. They knew each other's motive. Only two words were pronounced between them. Mrs. Reardon, he said. They did not look at each other when he pushed her into his bedroom and onto his bed, falling against her body as against a soft, stuffed object. Their faces had a look of secrecy, the look of partners in guilt, the furtive, smutty look of children defiling someone's clean fence by chalking sneaky scratches intended as symbols of obscenity. Afterward, it did not disappoint him that what he had possessed was an inanimate body without resistance or response. It was not a woman that he had wanted to possess. It was not an act in celebration of life that he had wanted to perform, but an act in celebration of the triumph of impotence. Cheryl unlocked the door and slipped in quietly, almost surreptitiously, as if hoping not to be seen or to see.